Welcome. We're going to go ahead and get started here. I want to welcome everyone to a webinar panel discussion, Finding the Unknown, a transition from doctoral student to professor in higher education. Joining us today for the discussion are panelists Vanessa Droit Anderson, Dr. Susan Barsinas, Dr. Jane Fleener, and Dr. Chad Hogan. We're going to have more complete introductions in just a minute, but to get started, my name is Dan Fagan. I am an AWCPE graduate student and also a Graduate Student Association member. The webinar today is being hosted by the AWCPE Graduate Student Association. And just a few words about the association, so that you understand a little bit about the background about today's meeting and also what we can do for you, not just today, but in the future. But based on our experience, we know that success in graduate academics often requires resources and networks that are beyond the format of the formal program of study. So the AWCPE GSA exists to help students think and do more with the resources here at NC State. The expertise of the AWCPE faculty, like those we have on the line and in the room with us, the administration, and also, importantly, the support of your peers. Specifically, AWCPE's GSA wants to enrich the educational and the social experience of all of the graduate students in the program. To do that, we promote interest of students by providing formal and informal communication between students, faculty, and administration. Today's an example of that kind of information. We also connect students, peers, faculty, and administration through social events, provide information and insights that are relevant to AWCPE students. And then also we serve as a sounding board and channel for formal student requests to AWCPE faculty and administration. So towards those goals, we wanted to host a panel discussion about some topics that are important for graduate students in the program. And our first such webinar that we're holding is focused specifically on the experience of doctoral students as they transition from their student status or even begin to think about transitioning from their student status into a role in academia as a professor. So that will be our focus of the discussion today. Panelists, you all know more than a little bit about this topic. Let's get rolling. Let's start with some introductions. I'll ask you to introduce yourself, and we'll start here with the three who are joining me in the room. You can tell us about yourself, your role, and if you have a snippet or a story or anything that you want to use to just frame the discussion briefly, feel free to share that as well. So let's go ahead and get started. I'll go right to left, beginning with Dr. Chad Hogan. Take us away.
Sure. I am Dr. Chad Hogan. I'm an associate professor here in AWCPE. I have been in a tenure-track position. This is my eighth year. Prior to that, I was 2 years in a teaching-track position, and prior to that, I had a completely different career. I didn't have any insight into how to obtain a position in higher education, and I failed miserably at it and got lucky when I finally got the job. So any insights I have are more due to hindsight and seeing how things have become easier for me over time. My insights being a search committee chair and then just mistakes I made.
Be very helpful.
And I'm Jane Fleener, and I'm a professor in the AWCPE program area. Before transitioning to this position, I was an academic dean for 17 years at three different institutions, and then before that I was a faculty member. So I've been doing this for a long time. My sort of beginning story was I finished my PhD and I went back to the classroom. And my advisor said, "Don't you think you ought to look for a job, in academe?" And it was like, well, okay. And that's not necessarily the best advice. I definitely didn't do any fore planning, so I appreciate that you guys are actually thinking ahead. Having said that, I was lucky because I was 5 for 5. I applied for 5 jobs and I went for 5 interviews and I was offered 5 jobs. And so I actually had pretty good success with faculty and actually with dean positions. Having said that, I've also hired a lot of people. So I have some insights on what people might be looking for when you're out on the job market.
Hi, this is Sue Barcinas. I'm also a faculty member in AWCPE. I've been in higher ed a long time, but not necessarily always in faculty roles. So I've done grants and contracts work, administration, full-time advising, and also worked as a research associate on a research team. And then again, academic leadership, and then came to a faculty position here at NC State. I learned something from all of those roles in higher ed, and I also learned how hard it was, even though most people really valued that varied experience, and I certainly feel like it has made a big difference when you're, I think, applying for your first academic position in terms of tenure track specifically. I think you have to present a relatively focused persona, so you have to figure out how to take those pieces of yourself and blend them together to show that's where you're well suited. So I did some planning for that transition and received a lot of conflicting advice along the way, which is kind of fun. And have also done a lot of search committee work. So looking forward to talking with everybody.
Good. Dr. DeRoyd Anderson, you're on the line with us. And you can push *6 if you're muted right now and introduce yourself, please.
Okay, can everybody hear me?
Perfectly, thank you.
Wonderful, thank you. So I'm Vanessa DeRoyd Anderson. I work in the graduate school on the professional development team. My role is overseeing the professional development programming, so I'm the senior director of kind of all of our career development and academic services. I also direct the teaching and communication program. Before I came here 3 years ago, I was on the tenure track for 3 years at a liberal arts college, and my PhD is in French, so it was kind of a big swerve, but I think the most interesting perspective that I have now in this role is that actually my academic path through French literature and language was the perfect preparation for helping people go in the academic job market. So I'm excited to talk about any range of things related to academia, preparing as a teacher, or the job search in general.
Well, très bien, merci. So thank you very much. That's awesome. Thank you for your introductions. And maybe just check, as Dr. DeRoyd Anderson did, for the audio. Dr. Anderson, can you hear us well enough? And any students, are you having a difficult time hearing us? Or is it clear?
I could hear everybody very well.
Okay, good. That should be the case for all connections then. That's perfect. All right, great. Well, just a couple of quick words about the format. We have several questions that we've pulled together that have been shared with the panelists. I can also take questions in chat. So we have the meeting going up here in Zoom. So if there's something specifically you would like to have the panelists cover, just send me that note in chat and we'll read that out. And so we'll go ahead and get started. We've got a lot of questions. So I think getting at least 2 perspectives from the panelists will be helpful in many cases so that we can then move on and try and cover most of our territory here. So if there are no other questions, we'll jump right in. Okay. So first question, I think, and we'll take these, we'll organize the discussion maybe a bit from a process point of view, beginning from thinking about engaging in the preparation and the search up through the interview and those sorts of transitional points as well. But we may bounce around a little bit. So first question, what were some of the steps you took to break into the world of becoming a professor? It sounds like there's a good variety of paths, and that's been my experience so far as well. You don't know what you're going to see around the corner. So maybe a couple of perspectives around steps that you took. So a little luck is good, so being ready to exploit that is great. But also any other proactive steps that you took that you might recommend in breaking through.
I think I'm the least qualified to answer that.
First of all, I have to comment on your title, Finding the Unknown. When I read that, first of all, I was very appreciative of the fact of there is this unknown out there, but it's also a little bit like the dog that chases the car and catches it and then wonders what to do with it. And I think part of preparation for what comes after your doctorate includes not necessarily having just a single goal. So you might be thinking in terms of, I don't really want to get a research, position. I just kind of want to teach, or I just kind of want to do working with professionals in a professional development situation or whatever. And I would advise you to stay open as long as you can and decide, what your passions are. And some of the questions later on, sort of address how you find that good match. But there's an unknownness to that match. And if you decide too soon what you think is known, like I'm going to be a tenure track faculty member in a research and extensive university, then you might actually block yourself off to some opportunities that, would be very, very exciting to you. So that's part of it, I think, is don't just focus on that one car that you're going to chase and catch it and then wonder what you're going to do with it.
I actually did a lot of casual conversations with people about what they liked about their jobs and roles. And I also did a lot of volunteering when I was a graduate student so that I could try things out and see what it was like. So some of them were paid opportunities and some of them were not paid opportunities. But I think a lot of that decision-making process and exploring what you want to do, but also in building things that you can list on your CV, but also draw upon if you do get the job and you need that experience, is to volunteer, whether it's to be on a research team or to present at a conference or to write, to teach, even if it's to guest teach a small portion or to help out. Those things were really useful to me, just basically shadowing people who had more experience.
Yeah. Then there's some things that just every position is going to require, so teaching experience. If it's a research position, they're going to require publications. so I would say I got lucky, but also, I didn't have teaching experience in higher education. And even though I'd owned a training company for 12 years and all I had done was teach adults, hiring committees didn't see that, didn't value that as teaching experience. But because I'd volunteered, as Sue said, to be a teaching assistant for a friend of mine, when I did look into a job, it was in part because they saw that I at least had that. I had teaching experience face-to-face and online, even just as a teaching assistant. Similarly, I didn't have any articles published because I didn't think I was going to be going into that type of position, but I did have an edited book published that I did just because I was passionate about it. But because I had that, it at least allowed me to be hired. But I think everybody, you need to know what absolutely is going to be required, or else you just won't have a chance, that you would not be considered. And that changes a little bit per type of position.
That maybe that would be a good question that we could pose to you, Dr. Droyd Anderson. From your perspective, how would a student, what would your recommendation be to students to really understand what is going to be required? Certainly there's conversations with their advisor, who's going to be plugged in to a great degree there, but what else might you suggest towards understanding those requirements?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. So I think, I don't want to just give you a bunch of negative examples about how I did everything wrong, including taking the first job I was offered, but I think my biggest mistake was not understanding how many different people I needed to be talking to. So thinking, I really respect the people on my committee, they're wonderful, they will have all the answers about my job search. And so going outside of your department, I think, is important, and going outside of your institution and figuring out what different institution types are looking for. So part of that process is figuring out what you actually like doing. I think I was so committed to having the title of tenure track assistant professor that I didn't consider how I actually wanted to spend my days. So for me, teaching has always been something I'm really passionate about. I really love working in a service role and helping develop people. And so, an R1 would not have been a good fit for me, but we all do our degrees at R1. So it's kind of hard to get outside of that mindset unless you intentionally seek out opportunities.
Great. Very good advice. That actually is a perfect transition into the next question, which is about fit. I think you hit on a great point. How do you want to spend your day, right? Titles, wonderful until you're sitting at the desk and you're miserable because you don't like what you're doing, right? So when you think about doctoral students that you have known personally, or maybe it's you, right? But when you think about people who you've known who have been successful at this, who've graduated and gone on to positions that were really well matched to their interests and their skills, what would you say that they did that really made the difference in finding a great fitting position? Some of that is certainly luck and timing. I think we all have to acknowledge. But what else have you seen that those individuals did, particularly thinking about the ones who you saw 2, 3, 5 years later, they're really in a role that's well suited for them? How did they do it differently?
I think that involves someone being willing to cultivate self-awareness, mm-hmm. and to really understand themselves as a component to that fit, and piggybacking on what was just said, on focused a little less on taking the first offer you get, on being intentional about fit, doing your homework and knowing what the environment would be like, and being authentic, mm-hmm. when you interview, where you're, whether it's ego or a sense of security or whatever it is, that you don't get into an interview and get sucked into a competitive mode of, I've got to land this job because I'm interviewing, as opposed to using the interviewing process to solidify, is this the right fit? Is this the job I want, not just whether they want me? So.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I could not agree more with that. I would actually say the most successful graduate student I've ever seen on the job market was the person who turned down most positions. Hmm. Because it wasn't right for her when she started. It wasn't going to be right for her in 6 years when she went up for tenure. And that's a lot of time to invest in a bad fit. And she got a lot of offers, and she held out for a position that was really well matched with what she wanted to be doing, and she really did treat the interview process like a dialogue rather than just, how I did. Again, with a negative example, I went in and said, I must get this job. Mm-hmm. I must be, competitive with my cohort. I have to be competitive with the other applicants. I have to land this job. It's a matter of pride for me, which I think is pretty destructive.
That actually segues so nicely to what I was going to say, because I think one of the reasons I was successful in job searches is because I really enjoyed them. And what I enjoyed about them is I was engaging in an interview process as well. And so it was a conversation, and it was really, you know, what do you like and what do you do? And you know, so it really, at the end of the day, when decisions were made, I was assured I knew what I was getting into, and they were pretty assured with what they were getting into. And so, having said that, and related to the first part of the conversation this afternoon, is also the idea of you can't sell from an empty wagon. You need to have some stuff in your wagon to sell. And so getting a job is not just about, you know, going and showing up and trying to write a really good application. You need to have some passions, like Chad mentioned. You need to have some things that really, you can say, here's who I am and here's what's exciting to me and here's how I can see myself with you. And, you know, I really want to be a part of your team. And I think those are all important. You know, one of the examples I have is I had a phenomenal student who could have gone to any high research intensive institution, but he was so passionate about teaching. He knew he did not want to go into administration. He knew he did not want to 100% be about writing. He's at a high research, but not a high intense research institution. He's a full professor. I see him on Facebook taking his students to China and doing things, you know, with math clubs and working in the schools with his students. And he is so passionate about working, you know, at that level that, you know, if he had gone somewhere where there was more pressure to publish or perish, he might not have enjoyed it as much, even though I know he could have done it. But that's something, too, is knowing what's in your wagon and what your passions are.
Good. Very good. I think that's important advice, and maybe a little unexpected for the audience to hear be so selective. You may have to say no several times before you find the right yes. So let's say for this next question, let's think about individuals who are successful in getting this interview and are going into it with the kind of authenticity that Dr. Barsinis mentioned and have know what they've got in their wagon to engage the discussion. That'll be a new experience for students today and as they're beginning to transition. What would you say about your own experience regarding the questions that you found most challenging in the faculty job interviews? So now we're sitting there, it's a panel or it's individual, you can set the context for us. What's that gonna feel like? What's that gonna look like? But then also specifically, what were the questions that you found most challenging, and how did you handle them? Or in retrospect, how did you wish that you had handled them?
I hate the question. Where do you see yourself in 5 years or 10 years? And you know, that's because that's a double-edged sword there, because on the one hand, if you're realistic, you shouldn't necessarily have this very, you know, clear image, because you need to be adaptive and responsive to your contexts. But at the same time, you don't want to be so superficial that you say, well, I want to be tenured and I want to have a good job and I want to, you know, make a lot of money. And so somewhere in between, you know, I want to be open to possibilities and I want this very pragmatic reality of making a lot of money and being tenured, you know, you've got to frame your answer in a way that communicates the things that you want to be able to do and how that then fits with that particular context. And the more you can tie back to the context, the better. So if you can say, I want to be able to, you know, work on such and such a research, and I see at your institution you have this, this, and this to facilitate that, or these people that are doing these things that I could see working with, the more you can connect back to that institution, I think the stronger case you make for showing you have a vision and that that vision includes how you fit into the institution.
Yeah, I mean, good. I want to follow up the next time I look for a job. So I'll start with saying the question I hate the most is, tell me about your greatest weakness. And then when I'm on the search committee, we don't ask that question. I can't stand that question.
Yeah.
And but I can't stand the answer of, I work too hard, or something like that, which is so obviously just a flip. You know, I think for me, the most powerful thing that I've done and that I've seen other people do is when they have a narrative about themselves as a professional, right? So if it's a research professor position and they have a narrative about, this is the research that I do, that I envision myself doing, this is the career arc I see for myself, and they can talk about it with passion. And then I would say that no matter what question you get, find a way to weave that back into that narrative, which is exactly what Dr. Flinger was describing, using different words. But I think that's important anyway. I mean, if going back to the authenticity thing, find a true narrative, a narrative that speaks to your passions and your interests and whatever, and practice telling that story before you show up to the interview. And then if you get a question like, what's your greatest weakness, or where do you see yourself, or whatever, find a way to weave it back into that narrative, because that's what I think the search committee is going to find to be powerful, that story of who you are.
So I think I'm going to go pragmatic with this answer. There's certain questions you can predict that you can prepare for authentically, but that will up your chances of being articulate in the moment. So for example, very often in a job ad, or if you are sleuthing on the web or with the materials that are sent to you before you go to an interview, you know what the curriculum is, and they may ask you what you see yourself teaching there. Or, if it's a research position or a tenure track research position, you know they're going to ask you about your research agenda. So I do think there's a value in being well prepared on the predictable questions, and being aware that I think times have really changed more so than not now. When you go to an institution, the search committee for that interview have pre-selected the same questions to ask every candidate. And so it's not entirely boilerplate, but there's not as much fluidity in your discussions as maybe you would like to be. And then the place where those more flexible conversations, where if you have something you really want to say and you can't work it in, that might be at your meals. It might be during your job talk. It might be during your interview with the dean or department head or something like that. So I think you need to have an awareness of that so that you can be strategic. If the something that you really want to say about yourself, if you don't have that opportunity in one of those interviews rather than the singular, then have a plan for how you might work that in indirectly in those other parts of the interview process.
Good.
I have one thing to add as far as predictability. You know, there are usually two stages to the interview process. One is the phone question for narrowing down the pool. So you may have made it into the top five or six candidates, and they're going to have telephone or airport interviews to determine who actually gets to come to campus to have the full 1 or 2 day interview. And during the initial interview, go back and look at the ad to be sure you can address all of the criteria in the ad. So if the ad has a specific, desired qualification in understandings of multicultural education, then you need to be ready, because they're going to ask every candidate that same question. You know, what is your experience in multicultural education? And so you can take the ad, anticipate the questions, and have some of those questions prepared, or your responses prepared. And folding that back into your narrative, that Dr. Hogan was describing, I think, is really valuable, because the more you can reinforce then, here's who I am and here's what I'm about in that narrative, the better.
I agree with that, and I alluded to the fact that I think my experience studying French literature was key to what I'm doing in this role now, and it's because my subfield was autobiography. And basically, job documents are really high-level miniature autobiographies that are intellectual and focused, but people respond to narratives about other people. Mm-hmm. They want to get excited about what you're doing. They want to get excited about your work. I find myself getting it, when someone writes a really good narrative, I find myself getting excited about topics that I never even knew existed as a total outsider. I would add too, since multicultural education was something that was mentioned, the question that I see people struggling with the most now in the job market is how do you contribute to diversity and inclusion in your teaching or research? And so I think being really prepared to answer that question, not on a superficial level, but thinking through actual actions that you take, either by making your research accessible, by making your classroom teaching inclusive in measurable, concrete ways, I think you really have to put a lot of thought into how you're going to present that consistently.
This is very, very helpful advice for the group. Thank you. Awesome. Well, let's, you know, we'll stay on the, this will be the last question around the candidacy part of the process and the interview, but sometimes it's helpful to kind of think about things on the flip side. So what about red flags? We've talked about a lot of good things to do. Please share some of what you would think are the red flags that might prevent candidates from nailing a faculty position, and what should they know before going into a phone or a face-to-face interview? And maybe you want to split this between first round and second round. I don't know what construct. Maybe you have two different sets of red flags depending on where you are in the process, but what comes most to mind when you think about, let's say, candidates who eliminate themselves? What would you say to that?
Oh, wow. Two things come immediately to mind. The first one is don't talk about money before it's time. Because you start asking about, now, how much is this position, you know, going to pay? First of all, it's not your position to be asking that about. And so keep money out of it for a while. But I think one of the really big red flags that I have seen over the years with a lot of interviewees is when in their, you know, part of the conversation is triangulating your own information. And so you're trying to meet with different groups to get a sense for what the institution is like. But if you go too far in that triangulation and start trying to get people to reveal their dirty laundry, and figure out, oh, you know, well, tell me about this Dr. Hogan. Is he really what I hear he's like? And you know, so I understand, you know, if you start saying things about colleagues that aren't even your colleagues yet, and you start to look very divisive and duplicitous in ways that should be huge red flags. And if people share information and find out that you've been asking questions about them or their research in ways that sounds demeaning or, you know, disingenuous, then it should be a huge red flag to them, and they will cut you out, because collegiality still does count and being professional is still very important.
I have three things, actually, and one applies to the entire process, and then two really apply to the campus interview. So the first one is that no matter where you are in the process, you have to let the process play out.
Right.
You can't try to circumvent what's going on. So, you know, if you start emailing members of the search committee asking for updates, if you start trying to do back channels, you know, you might if you have a faculty member who knows somebody at that institution, that's one thing, but you as a candidate should not be trying to reach out to members of the search committee to advance your case kind of off the books. I just think that's a really bad look. And then after you've been invited to campus, you know, you can send a thank you email, but asking for constant updates, I think, is not a great idea. And I see this in non-academic positions too, where, you know, you're trying to make a hire and someone just won't leave you alone. And I've seen people be disqualified just for that. In terms of the campus interview, I think you have to treat absolutely everyone with respect, which should be common sense. But when I was an undergrad and I was involved in campus visits, I've seen candidates not do that and really alienate people because they treated the administrative assistant like a personal servant, or they treated the undergrads like they weren't important and didn't have a voice in the process. And related to that, when you're on campus, every single part of your campus visit is part of your interview. Yeah. It doesn't matter if people are drinking. It doesn't matter if you're meeting with grad students or undergrads. It doesn't matter if you're in the car going to the airport with somebody. It doesn't matter if the person is on the search committee or not. Every single interaction you have is part of your interview, so you have to always be conscious of that, I think.
So I'm going to focus a little bit on the research part of it. I think that you have to be really meticulous. You want to put your best foot forward, but you want to be careful that the way you set up your CV and present yourself accurately reflects your work. So you want to be careful. It's really complicated now in terms of open source or paid journal articles versus peer review. So I would be really careful about making sure that your people will want to pull and read your work if you have publications or presentations. They want to be able to access it, not just an accurate citation, but know that if you put something under a peer review article and they get to it and it's a half a page editorial, that you can accidentally set off a search committee if they feel like you weren't careful and didn't take care in presenting your work, and that you're able to discuss it intelligently. So it's maybe not so much the case if you have a shorter CV, but when you start getting to the point where you have a longer CV, you may have to refresh your own memory on some things that are on there and make sure that if someone keys in on something that's not your most important kind of thing on there, that you can still recall and talk about it in a detailed, credible way. Because I have seen some things, not often, but once in a while, go a little bit sideways if someone's CV is just kind of thrown together and then people start digging. So it's really important. It's ethics, but it's also being able to really speak articulately about your own work.
Excellent. Okay, good. Very good. So we'll begin now to hit this in-between ground about the transition, but also the transition is built a bit on the foundation of what you've done before, so we may be bringing in some of those earlier bits as well. This next question asks, what's the one thing, okay, maybe there's two, but what's the one or two things that you wish you could have approached differently in your own doctoral program or in your transition to academia? As you're looking back now, what do you think, if I knew now, what would I have done differently?
Well, in my mind, it would be knowing what would be expected of me and making sure all those boxes were checked. So, and that's going to be different for the type of position, and it's beyond just, for instance, having some articles published in peer-reviewed journals. I mean, if you want a research professor position, you're going to need to have that. But one thing I've seen is that when people submit an application or they come in for an interview, and it's almost like every academic niche has its own conversations going on. conversations that seem relevant to them. And it's not one or two or three things, it's a bunch of things. But mm-hmm. but everybody on that committee has a sense for the relevant conversations for their little corner of the world. And sometimes people come from, let's say, a discipline that encompasses that, but they haven't been involved in the conversations of that niche. Mm-hmm. And they don't speak to it. And it's like you don't really get it. You're obviously not from our little corner of the world. And so I would just say, one, don't maybe not waste your time applying for positions that you don't understand that corner of the world. Or two, if you want to be marketable to a few corners of the world, just make sure that you're conversant in the kind of things that they're conversant in. What are the current conversations going on in that niche?
And are journals your primary source for that, or how would you supplement that with other? What would your sources be?
For me, the most powerful source for that were conferences. Mm-hmm. You go to conferences, you hear people talking, you're talking with people, and you should be able to get a sense of this is what people are saying. This is what people are wondering about. Mm-hmm. These are the problems that exist in the world that are on people's minds right now. And again, it's not one thing, and you don't have to know everything. Mm-hmm. But I get a sense when candidates come in that for interviews when they're not from this world. They're from a parallel universe, mm-hmm. doing something else, and it's just not a very good match.
Go ahead.
One of the things that drives my students maybe a little crazy, because it was a lesson learned for me, is when you pick your dissertation topic, you need to pick a topic that you can live with and that you're interested in, and that interest is going to carry you for at least the first 3 or 4 or 5 years of your professional career, especially if you're going into a research institution. So while it might be easy to pick a topic because your chair is interested in it, and you know, your chair does have to be somewhat interested in what you're doing, but just remember, you need to publish, you need to do follow-up research, you need to have something that will propel you for, you know, at least a few years, if you know, hopefully longer. And so, to me, that's why picking a dissertation topic is really important. And no pressure, but, you know, really make it something you can live with for a while.
No pressure, just get it right.
Yeah, yeah. don't do the easy thing, you know, is sort of what I'm saying there. And where I see that becoming so problematic, and I've seen this with some of my own students, they'll pick something because they think it's easy, and maybe it is easy and clean and a small piece of something, but then they never publish from it, and they can't really grow it into the next sort of research. And then they have to start all over. And that's okay, but starting over nowadays is really difficult, because if you go into a tenure track job, you get reviewed within your first 2 years to see if you're going to be reappointed. You know, so by your third year, if you're not already showing progress towards tenure, you get cut loose. And so you really need to be able to know that this is something that is going to be fruitful for you.
I'm not sure if what I would have done differently would apply to everybody, but one of the things that I always had to kind of work at balancing is that I like to explore different areas, and there were different points in time where I resisted being pinned down to one research area or one topic. And as you start funneling or getting nearer to the end of that, even if you're interested in something, I think it is important that you're able to be articulate about the connection between the different research projects or work that you're doing, the intellectual connection or the cohesiveness of it. And for some people that comes more naturally than others. What I would do differently is I would be very deliberate about looking to the people who do that well for the mechanics of how they do that well. Part of it is thinking, you know, how you think and how you frame things, But part of it is also how you express it verbally and in writing. And it's really helpful to be able to see when someone else writes on their faculty bio or on a letter or something, my work is about blah, 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 I am interested in this because, you know, and seeing how people actually articulate their intellectual world, I think, is super important. I didn't start paying attention to that until later, and I think that that is really stressful if you don't have practice doing it. So I would suggest you really look hard, whether it's at faculty bios on the web or whatever you have access to listen to how scholars describe their work.
I still have trouble.
Yeah.
Very, very good. Dr. Droyd Anderson, I think, you know, along the lines of the same question, and so you could answer it personally, or you might say, you know, what I wish doctoral candidates would do different in their programs or the transition, or you may have something to say about the institution here, about things that you wish we collectively would do different, but towards success in that transition, from your perspective, what do you see that you think doctoral students could do different and anticipating that now?
Yeah, well, I think there are two things, and one is that they should be thinking about that they should be thinking about what they're going to be doing from the first year of graduate school. So, you know, I see a lot of students who want to prepare for their job search when they're a year away from graduation, and that's a really hard time to start.
Mm.
The earlier you can start thinking about it and testing out different ways of conceptualizing your work as a narrative, I think the better. And then the other thing, which is related, is, at least this is my experience and I see it in a lot of students, you're getting ready to defend, you're tired, you're collecting your results, you're trying to figure out what they mean, this is the biggest project you've ever worked on, and you need to be presenting yourself not as the best graduate student, but as a future colleague. And so you already have to be thinking of yourself beyond the dissertation and not letting it take up the space in your application and in your interviews that it's taking up in your mind, but already thinking about what it's going to look like as articles or as a book or as a future research direction. And that was something I really struggled with, and I know I've seen lots of graduate students across the institution struggle with.
There were some heads nodding in here, and this seems like a really critical point, so I'm going to attempt a summary, and then I'm going to ask you all to correct me or modify this. What came to mind as I was hearing kind of the collection of answers here reminded me of something that was in the graduate student orientation here at NC State, and it was around research, and it was part of the onboarding, and the message was narrowing and defining your topic is part of the research. And so what I believe I'm hearing here is that the journey has an end, but you have to begin working yourself along the way and finding and making that path along, rather than waiting for it to materialize the year before you're about to graduate. I think you all said it better, but I'll let you comment or correct on that. Do you see a parallel there with kind of how you conduct research and how you're suggesting you engage in this transition?
I do, and I feel like I'm going back to something Dr. Bacinas said, but I think the real trick here is not just in, if we're talking about preparation during your doctoral program and preparation for a career as a researcher or something, that it's not just narrowing the topic of your research, but understanding the bigger picture of what is it that you research that this one study is illustrative of, right? And those mm-hmm. are kind of two different things.
Mm-hmm.
I did this one study for my dissertation, but what I research as a scholar is this, which is probably slightly broader, but it makes sense. So the kinds of future projects I envision myself doing is this, and this fits very well into the research that's going on here or the focus that your program has. So there's a little bit of a imaginative quality to it too. Not that we're making something up. I'm just saying, understand the bigger picture of what your dissertation research represents and be able to tell that story.
Awesome. Good, very good. I remind everyone that we've got chat available in Zoom, and if you would like to propose a question to the panel, please do that. We've got one from Paul here. Paul says, as a postdoc and TA, I realized that my PhD program taught me what to teach and not necessarily how to teach. How difficult was it for you all to find your teaching style in the classroom?
Great question, because I was going to bring up the issue of even every class you take, you ought to be thinking in terms of, you know, could I teach this class someday? Or if I were teaching this class, what would I do? And not in a critical way, but in a way of, you know, understanding and reflecting on, you know, what information you're getting out of classes. Because, you know, I think the hardest part is we fragment classwork from the dissertation, from the job market, and it's actually one big package. And so, but then more specifically, getting to the question about your style of teaching, that's a really insightful question, because what works for one person isn't going to work for everyone. So some people can be funny just walking up to the front of the room and get people laughing, and other people are very serious and are not very funny, or don't use humor, or when they use humor, it gets them into trouble. And, you know, I mean, so you do have to figure out who you are as a teacher. Some of that does take practice, but it also takes knowing your students. And a good example of that is the very first class I taught was a math methods class in an elementary education program, where I actually thought that these pre-service teachers liked math. And I did not realize that elementary education majors actually as a whole did not like math, had no confidence in their mathematical abilities, and really didn't, you know, want to talk about mathematics. And so I didn't know my population well enough to know that about them. And so that's another piece of knowing when you're teaching something, you know, now who are these students and how does it not only fit in the curriculum, but how does it fit with their vision of where they're going?
Excellent.
I'm going to go.
Go ahead.
I'm
sorry. I was just going to make a shameless plug because this is the area where I work really directly. If you want teaching experience and you don't have teaching experience and you want to learn how to develop a reflective teaching practice with input from lots and lots of people, I would recommend looking into the teaching and communication programs at the graduate school, because we offer certification at, you know, 100 hours of approved activity, where we actually put you in micro-teaching situations and you get feedback and you're recorded and you have the opportunity to develop over time, read some of the literature, and really develop. So if this is an area where you want to develop, we have a free program to help you. And the initial data I'm getting from people who are going on the job market is that they're asked about this program quite a bit, and they actually have videos and materials they've developed that they can use as evidence of their ability to teach successfully.
Awesome. And then Sue, if you want to wrap that one up.
Sure. I'm just going to move the line a little bit to talking about, in my opinion, you never stop developing as a teacher. You may take some resting points every now and again, but generally it's a craft that people cycle and evolve through. And one of the things that is really helpful, even if you're trying to balance your time management and say that you're tenure track and you're trying to balance your research and your service and your teaching, it is very helpful to not just plan your class time, but on your weekly basis or whatever that cycle is, to also calendar a little bit of time for your course prep and your grading, because those are the things that really get people in terms of time. Of, okay, I teach from 3 to 6, but I didn't mark the time that I need to prepare and be centered walking into that room or logging on online. And and also to reflect after or do your grading or your communication. So it's more time consuming than it looks, and you need to find a way to balance that. And it also helps tell you if your proportions are off. If you're spending too much time on one thing and not on another as part of your role, you'll have a more realistic picture of what you're doing.
Good. Very good. We've got time just for maybe one more question. We were going to get into questions around publishing the first article, et cetera. So I think, Nita, maybe we'll talk as a GSA about hosting a later webinar that could focus maybe on second steps. But let's stay on this current theme around teaching, because this is central to the transition and the focus of the webinar around moving into a professorial role. How would you describe your teaching philosophy in the room? I know that that's we could do a lengthy panel discussion on that, but maybe in a few words, if you could describe what is your personal teaching philosophy, maybe also how has it changed from when you transitioned and began your career as a professor versus how it is today could be interesting as well.
We're all kind of looking at each other. I think one phrase sort of sums up my teaching philosophy, and that is, it's not about me. And you always have to remember that it's not about you as the teacher. It's about your students, because there is no, learning if the student, there is no student if learning doesn't happen. And so that relationship between teacher and student is one that really necessitates that learning happens. So it's really about the learning. Having said that, that means to me that while I need to provide structure and clarity and frameworks and expectations and communication networks and all that sort of stuff in the most clear and concise way, I also have to build in adaptability to meet the needs of the students. And I'm a big, as Nita will attest, Freire fan. I believe that part of my job is to perturb people's thinking. And so in my helping students learn, and in my emphasis on a learning approach, I also have a job to push you guys a little bit. And figuring out how to do that is really important, because you have to do it in a way that is nurturing, supportive, caring, provide safety nets, all of that stuff, but that also does push and help people sort of achieve those limits or go beyond those limits.
Got time for one more perspective.
The frame I use when thinking about my teaching is that no matter what I say or do, students ultimately have to construct their own understanding of whatever it is we're trying to do. And so I think in terms of what experiences can I provide them with? What kind of scaffolding can I provide to give them the best chance to figure things out? Because I can't tell it to them and have them know it. I can't tell them to do this, write this paper, engage in this discussion, and that automatically happens. And so I find that when I teach, I bounce around between a lot of different things I do. But whatever I do is always coming at it from this perspective of they've got to figure it out on their own. With me sitting right next to them, it's still ultimately on their own to figure it out. And so I find myself designing experiences for students.
Excellent. Excellent. We've just run out of time, but I think that's probably a good point to, I'm going to say push pause, because I think based on what we've learned today, we know that this is something that we're going to want to do again. For the students who joined or who are listening to the recorded version of the webinar, You evidently get it. As Dr. Hogan said, you've got to do it on your own, and you're collecting information now on how to make that happen. I heard almost all the panelists, I think, say in one form or the other, I didn't see that. You know, I didn't know about it. I wish I could have known, but that's we're adults and that's how we learn. And so you're picking that information up here. And you're also going to have to play in between some boundaries that you heard, which was be open, be flexible, be creative. But you also have to be tuned in to the niches that you're targeting, and you need to know the conversations that are going on. And it's a process that's going to get you there. It's not an event, I think, is one of the things that came out of today's discussion. If this was helpful for you, then I'm guessing that you had an aha moment on two or three or five things that you need to get busy doing. That's what we hope here. If you thought this was helpful, we're going to be posting this, and I would ask you, please let your peers know. Because part of our purpose as a graduate student association is to help each other. So help your peers by letting them know that this was a good discussion, and ask them, tell them it would be worth an hour of their time to flick this on. If you can think of a way that we could make this format or this discussion better next time, the emails are on the invite or on our website, and you can contact any of us and let us know how we can improve. We want to do that. So Dr. Droit Anderson, Dr. Barsinis, Dr. Fleener, Dr. Hogan, thank you for giving an hour of your time up. Really, really helpful discussion. And we're going to look forward to doing this again sometime soon.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Take care. Have a great afternoon. Stay dry.